welcome to the Divided Kingdom, the evening news program from a Christian vantage point that many of you have come to know and look forward to. This is Elizabeth Cuppett Caverly, and a little later, my colleague, Lou Caverly, will be with us too. We're not very far out from Easter, and we hope that some of you have heard Pastor Carl Sanders in a repeat program talking about the proofs of Jesus' resurrection. There's really nothing more important because we're all alive, we're all humankind, and we will all die. No matter how elite we are, no matter how rich or poor, we all will face that grave, and we all want to know what will happen to us at that time. Do our lives end? Do we just go back to the clay? Or do we continue? And where do we go when we continue? Do we go to heaven? Is heaven real? Do we go to hell? Is hell real? Well, we do believe that those two entities are very real. And we'll have a lot of news here for you tonight. It's very important. And we hope that you will tell others about our program and also our exciting news that through the wonderful help of Global Star Communications, we now have our archives. And you can go to the Divided Kingdom. .org. Again, that is our website, thedividedkingdom.org. And you can look at the programs that we had in March of this year, you know, just past, month past, and you can hear our talks about the ice ages. Yes, there's really a lot of information there that I think you'll want to hear. You can listen to our program, and you can see the synopsis of the programs, and you can pick the ones you want to hear. Now, at this time, we can go back to April of 2014, and you can hear past programs that far back. So we really want to thank Global Star Communications for this help. We want to thank WWCR for their wonderful help. There was a little glitch last week on a program, and it was nothing that they could help. A transmitter just sort of didn't kick in, and they immediately fixed it when they were notified. Now, on that program, it was very important that some of you probably gave up hearing because the program didn't really come on till about 7:25 Central Time, so 25 minutes were lost. In that program, we talked about the story of Betty Maltz, and I think it's important for me to recap that story again, because when I first opened this program, I talked about where we all have to go at death, and we want to know more about that. Well, if you have ever heard of Catherine Marshall, she was married to Peter Marshall, and he was the Senate chaplain back, I think, in the 40s or early 50s. And he died rather young, at about age 42, of a heart attack. And Catherine Marshall herself had had a rather trying life. I think early in their marriage, she was bedfast with tuberculosis. Yes, that old-time disease that might make a big comeback if we get a lot more open borders. Anyway, she was his wife, and they had one child, Peter Marshall Jr. And so after his death, it was a shocking death because he was so young. She eventually remarried to Leonard LeSword, and he was an editor, a Christian editor. So this takes place probably in the 1950s. I believe it was 1956, something like that. And Betty Maltz, M-A-L-T-Z, I believe, was visiting Catherine Marshall and Leonard LeSword, and she had her small daughter, age 6, with her. So the story was this, that years before, Betty had gotten ill, and they did not find right away that it was appendicitis, and peritonitis set in, and it was really, really, really bad. All of her organs were damaged, and she actually died. So while she had, quote, died, her parents were notified, and her father was a minister, so he set out to go to the hospital, and he did not know that she had died yet. When he set out to go to her bedside, the phone rang, and his wife picked it up and was told that she had died. So she was very worried that he would come upon the corpse of his daughter, Betty, and be very, very upset to have to be thrust into that so suddenly. Well, during Betty's excursion, we'll call it, she described going to, I guess we would say, the gates of heaven and hearing beautiful singing, and angels spoke with her, and they said, do you want to go on in? And she said, no, I'd like to stand here a little while and join the singing and then return to my family. So what really happened was that her father went into the room, and there she was, a corpse. And suddenly she came back to life. And she described it that as she came back to life, she was seeing these letters, sort of translucent letters, and they were scripture. I am the resurrection and the life. And, you know, I can't quote the rest of it right now. I don't have the Bible next to me, but I believe it's from John. And it was the promise to each of us that if we come to Jesus, our lives go on into eternity. And so this was a thrilling thing for her to see the actual scripture in, what can I say, it wasn't just words in a book. It wasn't just scriptural words in a Bible. They were living. In some way they were living, and at that moment she was thrust back into life, and her father was just so surprised. Now, doctors later told her that she should never have children because she probably would never be able to, that all her organs were so damaged, and she would have to have a colostomy, wear a bag, and she would have all these things wrong with her. None of that ever happened. And there, Catherine Marshall noted in her writing of this account, there was this little six-year-old child jumping around just as normal, playing with the horses on their farm. She was perfectly fine. So many of us have experienced things that we believe indicate to us we'd better stay where the gate is straight and not take the wide way. In this radio work, all of you do know that Lou and I have been financing this program since the year 2003, when we began. October 17th of that year, we signed the contract. And we've had our ups and downs. We've had some disillusionments with mankind. But that's what it is. Each of us is desperately wicked. We know that the Bible tells us the heart of man is desperately wicked. And if you think you're not a sinner, then you are deluded. We all are, and we all need to repent every day. And we sort of know many times when we've stepped out of line because God gave us a conscience. But the times are getting worse. In fact, the biggest worry I think that we have right now, of course, would have to be, are we going to head toward a nuclear showdown with Russia? And we need to pray very, very much about this. People are questioning, well, why would Russia have some of its ships and everything near our coast? Well, are they just doing a little drill? But we look back December 28th, Sunday, in the AP of 2014, and the headline was, New Russian Doctrine Calls NATO Top Threat. And this was by Vladimir Isachenkov from the AP. Russia identified NATO as the nation's number one military threat and raised the possibility of a broader use of precision conventional weapons to deter foreign aggression under a new military doctrine signed by President Vladimir Putin on Friday. NATO flatly denied it is a threat to Russia and accused Moscow of undermining European security. The new doctrine, which comes amid tensions over Ukraine, reflected the Kremlin's readiness to take a stronger posture in response to what it sees as U.S.-led efforts to isolate and weaken Russia. The paper maintains the provisions of the previous 2010 edition of the military doctrine regarding the use of nuclear weapons. It says, Russia could employ nuclear weapons in retaliation for the use of nuclear or other weapons of mass destruction against the country or its allies, and also in the case of aggression involving conventional weapons that, quote, threaten the very existence of the Russian state. But for the first time, the new doctrine says Russia could use precision weapons, quote, as part of strategic deterrent measures, end of quote. The document does not spell out when and how Moscow could resort to such weapons. Examples of precision conventional weapons include ground-to-ground missiles, air and submarine-launched cruise missiles, guided bombs, and artillery shells. Among other things, the paper mentions the need to protect Russia's interests in the Arctic, where the global competition for its vast oil and other resources has been heating up as the Arctic ice melts. Russia has relied heavily on its nuclear deterrent and lagged far behind the U.S. and its NATO allies in the development of precision conventional weapons. However, it has recently sped up its military modernization, buying large numbers of new weapons and boosting military drills. It has also sharply increased air patrols over the Baltics. Earlier this month, and we say again, this was in December of 2014, Russia flexed its muscle by airlifting state-of-the-art Iskander missiles to its westernmost Kaliningrad enclave bordering NATO members Poland and Lithuania. Now, after this article, we then heard about NATO's big convoys very arrogantly going around through probably Latvia and Lithuania. So we continue to poke the Russian bear, and it can't bode well for any of us. So we do ask you, Christian people, to pray, to intercede, to plead with God, to change the hearts, to awaken the reprobate mind, to get some of those people in the Pentagon who may be under this spell of Satan, in which they can't think clearly. They're ditzy because woe to them who believe that evil is good and good is evil. They're so confused, but just reawaken them. We ask the Lord to think about their children, their grandchildren, to think about the reality. If anybody set off nukes in a nuclear war, it wouldn't be worth living for any of us. That's absolutely the truth. And God has helped us before at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So we do ask for that prayer very much. Now, as individuals in our lives, we want to look back, as I told you there about Betty Maltz's inspirational story. There were some other things lately that we can see God does not abandon his own. Actually, Ted Cruz in Time magazine April 6th was quoted as saying, "I believe God isn't done with America yet." Well, whether or not Ted Cruz has a future in a very unlikely, dark horse, miraculous thunderbolt way from heaven as our president, which will never happen unless we have repentance and the beginnings of a great awakening here, turning back to Jesus Christ and our roots. We will never see him as president. And Rand Paul, yes, we know he's running, but how can I feel good about his Christian walk? Anyone who would come out taking a strong stand against the harms in vaccines and then show himself on the internet getting a booster shot. How can we be filled with hypocrisy and mean anything at all? We will not have our salvation through the libertarian movement, through the patriot movement. We will not have that. And yes, I know I wrote Patriots Warning 1 and 2, and at that time, I think I didn't realize fully the extent of the evil control of the New World Order and how very much the battle is joined down in the spiritual, deep, dark caves and the caverns of Satan. This is where it really is. We cannot do it ourselves. We can be as patriotic as we want. Yes, the Americans all still have their guns. That's right. This may not be an imminent takeover, as Colonel Jim Ammerman thought in the 1990s when he alerted America. It might not be imminent, but it's eroding constantly the quality of our life, and not just the quality of our economy. But think about Ted Cruz's words, "I believe God isn't done with America yet." And I believe that he isn't, as long as there are some families like this one family who stood for Jesus Christ. And I'm going to be reading to you out of Southern Living, March 2015, what stands in a storm. And they had this footnote there, really, I guess, a little preface. On April 27, 2011, one of the deadliest tornado outbreaks in history ripped through the South. Former Southern Living editor-at-large Kim Cross documented this story of tragedy and hope in our August 2011 issue and in her new book, What Stands in a Storm, out this month. This exclusive excerpt tells the story of one Mississippi church's resilience in the force of the destruction. 3:44 p.m., April 27, 2011, Smithville, Mississippi. The pastor of Smithville Baptist Church was sitting on the red brick steps that had led to 520 Sunday sermons, watching the funnel part the horizon. It was off in the distance, maybe a mile or two. He could see where it was, but not where it was going. And two heartbeats later, he could feel it breathing down upon him. He turned to his youth minister and said, "It's here." And the two of them began running. They sprinted across the parking lot to the two-story Sunday school wing, the oldest and strongest part of the church. And they ducked into a low-ceilinged room where 11 others, children, parents, a small dog, were huddled together, terrified. For 15 long seconds, the world hung suspended. The winds punched through the windows and pelted the people with pieces of trees and homes and dreams. It peeled tiles off the ceiling and tugged at them like a great invisible hand trying to turn the church inside out. They held fast to the walls, to a bookshelf, to anything still there. With a thunderous clap, two large sheets of metal from the fellowship hall slammed down over the two nearest windows, shielding Pastor Wes and his people from the blender of debris. One room over, the storm speared a 2x4 through the wall. So loud was the roar that they did not hear the church fall. Two blocks away, Johnny Parker cowered in his hallway with his sister and father. He had always dreamed of seeing a tornado, but never imagined he would find himself caught in the teeth of an EF5. His ears popped, muffling the roar that sounded like a 747 jet screaming inches from their heads. Even through the deafening noise, Johnny's father heard a voice. It was a man's voice, deep and loud. "Move!" Randy reacted reflexively, not pausing to question, "Get in the bathroom!" Chloe clawed her way through the dark upon her hands and knees, dizzy and disoriented. It felt like the room was spinning. She felt Johnny in the tub and clambered on top of him, holding his head as he screamed. In the sliver of light through the bathroom door, she saw the south end of the house implode, sending a door frame and a crystalline shower of glass hurtling down the hall where they had just been. But where was her father? She could not see him, and she knew, in the deepest part of her gut, that if he was not in the bathroom, he was dead. In those eternal seconds of thrashing, pounding horror, she felt certain that her mother was dead, that she and her brother were orphans. The thought made her preternaturally calm, because she knew she would have to be the one to find their parents' bodies to take care of Johnny. They could move in with their grandparents if they both survived. The windowless bathroom became a tilt-a-whirl, and she felt the floor dropping out from under her, but the floor was not dropping. Chloe was levitating, sucked from the grips of gravity and into the terrible mouth of the storm. The supercell towered 3 miles above the earth as its funnel child tore mercilessly through the heart of Smithville in a tantrum of annihilation. It plucked a red Ford Explorer up like a matchbox car and buried it into the town water tower half a mile away. The SUV flew another quarter mile and cratered a field. The storm lifted the cab of a tractor-trailer, flung it more than a quarter mile into a field where it landed and crumpled like foil. It blew the town hall apart, wrapped cars around trees and smashed apart buildings, flinging concrete cinder blocks like Legos. It plucked trees from the ground and scoured the bark off the few that stood. The tornado sucked homes right off their foundations, leaving nothing behind but a lonely slab with the anchor bolts that once held down the walls. It sucked people into a hateful sky and pelted them to death with shards of the places they trusted to protect them. Patty Parker ran up, breathless, to find the front of her house shorn off, the scraps of her walls heaped on the porch. She began screaming for her husband, Randy! The past and the future dangled in the moment, her universe suspended in the purgatory of uncertainty. Somewhere under the house lay three pieces of her heart. They were alive, or they were dead. Blocks away at Smithville Baptist, Pastor Wes and his people picked their way out of the fallen church. No one in the church was killed, but their sanctuary was buried under a mountain of bricks and glass. And yet, a single window somehow survived with only one small crack. It was the stained glass window of Jesus with outstretched arms, which Johnny's grandparents had donated. Isn't that a wonderful conclusion to that excerpt? You see, as for me and mine, we will serve the Lord. There are rewards to serving the Lord when terrible things come. No, not everybody is always saved. We've heard stories of a wonderful Christian father and mother who lost maybe five or six children in a car accident, and then we have to ask, why God, why God? But we never lose our faith because we have the eternal promise. God is all good, and he works everything for good to those who love him. So in this story, I believe we will find out, we're not certain, that I think the father, the mother, and the children did live. And they do say here in Southern Living, for updates on people featured in this story, visit southernliving.com/tornado. Again, that is southernliving.com/tornado. And again, we hear Ted Cruz's words, I believe God isn't done with America yet. He's not done with you. If you're a Christian seeking to serve him and your heart is repenting every day of any kind of hatred, anger towards your neighbor, any kind of fanaticism, any kind of hatred of the Jews or of the Muslims, we're not to hate anybody. We're not to hate. We can't be Jesus's if we are hating. No, we can't. And now there was another interesting story that we all heard about, and that was the baby that was rescued from the wreck in the icy river. And on Tuesday, March the 10th, they were giving an update here, and I think Lou will tell you what he heard, too. I'm not sure that this little article really tells about the extra thing that showed perhaps God's intervention. Welcome to the program, Lou.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here. This is entitled Baby Better After Rescue from Wreck in Icy Water by Brady McCombs, Associated Press. Dateline Salt Lake City. Police responding to a report from a fisherman about an overturned car in an icy Utah river were stunned to discover an 18-month-old girl dangling in a car seat inside, unconscious but alive. They found the baby in the back seat and a woman dead in the front seat after flipping over the car. A firefighter jumped into the river and cut the car seat straps, freeing the blonde baby, who was wearing only a flannel onesie and no hat or gloves. Officers then formed a line in the river and handed the cold child from one person to the next until she was on the shoreline and in an emergency worker's arms. 2 days later, the toddler is recovering at a hospital, though authorities still don't know exactly how she survived, hanging upside down for nearly 14 hours in frigid temperatures with no food or water. Quote, it's heartbreaking. Was she crying most of the night? Spanish Fork police officer Tyler Beddoes said. He went on to say, it's a miracle. She was needed for sure elsewhere, unquote. Beddoes spoke to the family and on Monday recounted the ordeal. Police believe the crash occurred when the child's mother, 25-year-old Lynn Grosbeck, struck a cement barrier on a bridge and careened into the river, late Friday in Spanish Fork, about 50 miles south of Salt Lake City. Grossbeck had visited her parents in Salem and was about halfway back to her home in Springville when it happened, Spanish Fork Police Lieutenant Matt Johnson said. Investigators don't know what caused the crash, he said. There were no skid marks or signs of mechanical failures in the mid-size car. Police don't suspect drugs or alcohol as a factor, but are awaiting toxicology results. Grossbeck might have been tired or distracted, Johnson said, adding authorities weren't ruling anything out. Even though the road that goes over the bridge gets plenty of traffic, no one saw the wreck because the cement barrier obstructed the view below, Johnson said. If a fisherman hadn't chosen that river that morning, it could have been several more hours before the car was found, he said. The overturned car was perched on the bank and rocks. As the girl dangled inside, icy water rushed just below her head through broken car windows. The temperatures were near freezing throughout the night and through the morning. Beddoes said, quote, she must have been just out of the water enough to be getting oxygen, unquote. When the four officers responded to the vehicle, they didn't know how long it had been there or who was inside. After freeing the girl from the car, responders rushed her to an ambulance and performed CPR, Beddoes said. On Monday, Lily Grossbeck was in stable condition and improving, according to hospital officials. Beddoes said the girl was opening her eyes and doing well. Lynn Grossbeck was enrolled at Provo College with the goal of becoming a medical assistant, her sister Jill Sanderson told the Deseret News.
So sad that the mother died, but this article from the AP certainly doesn't give what you heard, Lou, the great Christian encouragement. Tell the listeners what you heard.
Yes, I heard this on one of the main radio stations. I think it was CNN Radio, or the CNN Radio version of what's on the TV. And they said that when the rescue workers were nearby, someone heard a voice. Now, as it says in the article, the child was unconscious. Someone heard a voice saying, help, help, or words to that effect.
And wasn't it a woman's voice, didn't you say?
Yes, I believe it was. I don't remember all the details, but I believe that's the case, yes.
So we could interpret this as God letting an angel be there, something in which the late mother was very concerned and wanted her baby to be saved. And these things do happen. God does protect his own when it is his will. We have another story here. It was in the AP on March 8th. Church says abducted missionary is now safe. Seattle. A 71-year-old Seattle missionary abducted last month from a school in Nigeria has been released and is safe, the Free Methodist Church USA said Friday. In a statement on the church website, Bishop David Kendall said the Reverend Phyllis Sorter was released Friday evening, Nigeria time, into the care of authorities and Free Methodist Church leaders. Armed men abducted her February 23rd from the Hope Academy compound in Emeworo, Kogi State. Quote, we are deeply grateful to all who prayed for Phyllis's safe return, and praise God the family representative was able to secure her release, Kendall said in his statement. He provided no details about how the release was arranged. Quote, as a matter of sound policy and to help protect the many, many people who helped secure Phyllis's freedom, we will have no comment concerning the efforts that were undertaken to secure her release, the bishop said. In a response to an AP email seeking additional details, Kendall declined to go beyond the website statement. In the Seattle area, stepson Richard Sorter reacted with delight. Prayers are answered, he told King TV, adding, you've got to believe this doesn't happen very often, and we're praising God. Friends have described Sorter as courageous, tenacious, and passionate about helping the people of Nigeria, and said she was aware of the dangers. Quote, if you knew Phyllis, you'd just think positive, her stepson said Friday night. She is the most straightforward, religious person you'd ever know. Only good things could come out of this for her. Koji State Police said shortly after the abduction that the men who took Sorter had initially demanded a ransom of nearly $300,000. So we can see there the work of the Lord. His power is omniscient and omnipotent, all-knowing and all-reaching. I am often cautious about telling what happened after my father's death, but I believe I will tell it one more time to listeners who have not really heard it. First of all, my father was a very ordinary middle-class person. He was a rural mail carrier in western Pennsylvania, traveling up into the Allegheny Mountains, dirt roads even at that time. He loved his beloved farm there nestled in the western Pennsylvania foothills of the Allegheny Mountains. He was very active in his Methodist church all of his life. And my mother told me that he had been saved at about age 15. And those who were there at the church service said it was just a very beautiful experience for him to be saved. And of all the people I've ever known in my life, I would have to say that he pretty much emanated the love of Jesus Christ more than anyone I ever knew. He was not flawless. He and I had a little upset after I was married to Lou, in which Satan took him over once. I wanted him to help out to save a woman's home, she and her children. We had tutored, and we knew that she had a heart problem. And he just folded his arms, and he says, "Let the government help her." I just couldn't believe it, and I was so upset and disillusioned that I didn't speak to him for 6 months. I would avoid the telephone when he called. And finally, my mother began to realize something was terribly wrong, and she ferreted it out of me, so she told him. And then he wept, and he wept, and he says, "What have I done to Elizabeth? What have I done?" He had great remorse, because he was really the one who took care of me as a little baby. My mother was ill. He changed my diapers. He really bonded with me. And my mother later said, "I don't think there was ever a parent who loved a child more than your father loved you." So eventually, we met each other. It was so painful that we didn't meet in our own home. We met in a restaurant some distance from my Pennsylvania home. And even years later, if I would ever bring up this woman's name, he would look, he would wince, and he would say, "Please don't bring up that name. It was so painful." But you see, God heals things. And of course, we had a solid, loving relationship there that was just very wonderful. On my wedding day, we were standing outside our home here where we were married, a little like a garden wedding. And I read a poem out loud that I had written for the occasion, and he turned and he whispered, he says, "You wrote that, didn't you?" See, he knew, because spiritually and emotionally, we were so in tune with each other. It was a wonderful relationship. And, you know, if you're a father out there, I urge you never to be abusive to your daughter. Never make her feel like dirt. No, let her feel she can do anything in the world. Triumph in her achievements, and just be kind to her all your life, because I certainly merited from this. Well, anyway, what happened in 1976, I was ill, and I couldn't go to work to teach that year, and I really didn't know that that was going to be the case, but I turned out to have hypoglycemia, very severe. My blood sugar was 40 for 6 weeks, and I had a heart problem, so I fortunately was able to draw a disability from my school system and stay out that year. And I never knew till many years later, in 2004 at my mother's funeral, the person who had made that decision, helped to make that decision, was a childhood friend. He says, "Your name came up, and I saw that you got the disability." So you see, there, God was watching out for me, or I would have never been able to stay here in Maryland. I would never have met Lou. We would never have been able to join to do this radio program that you're hearing. And we do hope you will write to us at Lou and Elizabeth Caverly, Caverly, The Divided Kingdom, P.O. Box 28, Bethlehem, just spelled like in the Bible, Maryland, 21609. Again, that is P.O. Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. So what happened in 1976? I felt like calling my first cousin. And she was many years older than I was because my father was born so late in life to his parents. In fact, I've commented before that my grandfather was born in 1859, before the Civil War, which is astounding to me when I think about it. So at any rate, when I called her, we had a wonderful reunion, and we said how close we were, like sisters, not cousins. Then she said, "You know, Elizabeth, I know your nerves can play tricks on you, but I was outside on my back porch watching the telephone lineman fix some wires that had come down in a storm, and as if he were standing there, I heard my late father's voice say to me clearly, 'Come on, Betts.'" She explained to me, because I barely remembered her father's funeral when I was just sort of little more than a baby, she explained that Betts was her childhood nickname used only by her father, Eugene. And she said, "Do you think this means I'm going to die?" And I laughed this off. I said, "Oh, no, no." And I said, "When I feel better, I'll be driving home to see you." And we ended the telephone call in a lighthearted way. Well, about 4 days later, my father called me, and in his very kind way, he said, "I don't want you to get too upset, Elizabeth." And he said that my cousin had passed away of a sudden heart attack. We moved the clock farther ahead to 1988, the time when I had had a small heart attack, and I knew now that I had lupus, and I had spent the winter bedfast because of the flu, all of that together. And I was finally able to go home to see my parents. And my father had gotten shingles late in life, and he had the dreadful kind that is a facial pain that is just horrible. My mother read that many people committed suicide from this pain if it hung on, and his hung on. So we were sitting there in the kitchen, and we had certain places we always sat. My father was always across from me. And I looked over, and I saw how thin he was, because he was a very sturdy, physically strong man. And I thought, "Oh, you're so thin. How can I bear to lose you?" And out loud, I just blurted the way a child would. Now, there was no divination. There was no channeling. There was nothing like this. It was just a child saying, "Daddy, if we can, whichever one of us dies first, let's send the other one a message." And he looked at me, and he kind of laughed, and he says, "Well, my father said we would hear from him," and he chuckled, his little Irish chuckle. He says, "We never heard a word." And his father was a choir director and a small-town banker and a farmer, but they really lived in poverty. And his mother, then as a widow, had to struggle greatly because his father dropped dead of a heart attack when my dad was only 12 years old. So that changed things dramatically for him. Well, then, as we're sitting there, I brought up this memory of what my cousin had heard about her father saying, "Come on, Betts." And when I brought that up, my father's jolly nature just completely changed, and he got that very serious look like we've seen on pictures of George Washington. I'm not exaggerating, am I, Lou?
No, I think that's a very fitting description. That would be exactly how he did look.
Because Lou knew him well, too. And so, at any rate, he thought about that, and I thought he'll remember that. So that was 1988. And then we move up to Christmas 1991. We had a wonderful time together as a family. And at that point, my father had these two smallest grandchildren. The youngest was 2.5 years old, and the other one was about 5.5. And we took a little picture, and I'm beaming, but the small one, age 2.5, and my father both have somber looks, almost as if they knew the future was soon coming, that we would not be together anymore on Earth. So after Christmas, they thought my father had the flu, and they took him to the hospital, hooked him up to oxygen, and he jokingly said, "Bring me some pens," because he was selling World Book Encyclopedias, even at age 81. And he would call on the phone, and he sold the second generations of many people he had sold before. He loved families, and he wanted to help them and help their children succeed in school. So he had these little pens that he would give out. And he says, "Bring me some pens for the nurses." And he used to embarrass us. We didn't really like to go out to eat. He would want to give these pens to waitresses, and we were saying, "Oh, no, Daddy, we don't know you." But he had that humorous aspect, too. But he was doing some lung breathing exercises, and his wonderful heart stopped. And that was it. Had a very peaceful death. So I spoke at his funeral, and I said how he always honored Jesus Christ. And then we came back to Maryland. I guess it was, his funeral was Friday. And on a Monday evening, Lou was going to go to a neighboring town to do something to tutor a student. And I said, wait a minute, there comes a car driving up. And it was from the local flower shop. And Lou and I had been helping the little farmer children behind us free. They needed help with their reading and some of their school subjects. And my father had known about this. And one time when I complained to him on the phone that I didn't know whether they appreciated that this was free, and I said, but I don't think they're rich. And he said, Elizabeth, I know they're not rich. Because he had visited them one time to see their big irrigation equipment, which was so different here in Maryland from, he didn't have anything like that in Western Pennsylvania. So I knew what he meant. Keep helping them. Do not think about the money. Do what is right. Show love to those little children. So I think it's very significant that this miracle came through that family because they had ordered flowers from a little flower shop called the Garden Basket here in rural Maryland. And when I took the flowers and I looked at the card, I was confused. Then I began to weep, didn't I, Lou?
Oh, yes, that's exactly right. I remember that crystal clear to this day.
And Lou said, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I said, well, look, my real name is Phoebe Elizabeth. But that card did not say Phoebe. It said Susie. Susie. Now, Susie or Susie Q was my childhood nickname used only by my father. And Lou, you've commented as a math teacher and a statistician about my first cousin hearing her childhood nickname, Betts, and my receiving that card with this on. And I'll let Lou tell you what he thought statistically the odds of this being a coincidence were. And also in the meantime, the farmer's wife who had ordered the flowers said, I'll find out about this. She phoned the little flower shop. She said, I know the four women who work there. None of them could explain anything about it. And when she got her bill, it said arrangements for Susie. There's no way that anyone on earth knew about this but the Lord.
That's right, because I have only the vaguest memory that when I first knew you, Elizabeth, your father would once in a while say Susie Q, but I had completely forgotten it by that time. And I would say the odds of that being just, an unimportant coincidence, and also your cousins combined with that, maybe one in a million. Certainly, I think that's in the right ballpark.
You've taken it down a little over the years. You originally said 1 in 3 million. But, you know, that's enough, isn't it? That's enough. Either 1 in 1 million, Jesus is enough. And I believe that my father is happy that we have answered the call to come to you here on the radio. And again, I point out that we do not believe in spirit guides. We do not believe in channeling. These things are of Satan. But you see, this thing that happened for me was not something that I was channeling. God just let it happen. And I believe very much that it was an encouragement to us in these worsening times that we're going into, that we're to hold fast. Look at those Christians in Syria and everywhere else who are just suffering so very, very much. It's just terrible what has happened. I was trying to see here what happened to the abducted ones. I think we had a little article about that, if I see, where they were moved. I may not see that right away. Yes, here we are. Let's just sort of see that article, February 26th, a little bit about it in the AP. Islamic State militants have moved a large group of Christians they abducted to one of their strongholds as fighting raged on Wednesday between the extremists and Kurdish and Christian militiamen for control of a chain of villages along a strategic river in northeastern Syria, activists and state-run media said. Now, we haven't had much of an update on that. On True News, we heard the head, Julianne, not sure of her last name, of the Iraqi Christian Relief Council, and she was talking about her colleague named Violet that some of her very family members were taken, and they did not know whether they were alive or not. So you see, we must be strengthened because we don't know what we're going to have to stand here in America. But the reality is that Jesus is real and the Bible is true. And we hope that next week you will tune in for an interesting program with Al Cuppett, who will be talking about biblical numerology. Now, when we get into nothing is as it appears to be, we've been talking about Jesus' world and everything is true and everything is good. And, you know, he does help us. He helped me when I was there crippled with the Lyme disease for almost 2 years. Lou, what would you have said if someone had said I'd be walking without a cane, without a walker, and I would be doing radio work at this time?
I would simply have told them that's very optimistic, but I don't believe it, and I don't think there's any chance of it, and I just can't believe it would be possible.
You would have said you're crazy, wouldn't you?
Yes.
You really would. But now we have to be getting under some of these things and seeing the people who are not following Narrow is the Gate and some of these secrets that Satan is in control of people when they don't even know it. Here we saw in Globe, the tabloid, here was a picture of David Letterman. And they said, he's a soul man, S-O-L-E. They said, oops, David Letterman must be getting forgetful. The talk star was fully equipped for a jog during a Caribbean vacation, except for his shoes. Now, the picture shows him walking in the sand in his socks. But that's not the part that interested me. With both of his hands, he is making what some have said to be the sign of the devil, the horned sign. And his eyebrows are looking very intently. There's an odd expression. Now, I'm not saying that he's devil-possessed or he is even being afflicted by the devil, but I am just noting what some have said about this sign. And we can see how destructive this celebrity ideal is, because most of them probably don't believe in a Christian God and certainly not in Jesus. They wouldn't believe in the cross, that we have to come to the cross and put our sins there. We have Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. We have the Examiner saying, for months, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie's 8-year-old daughter, Shiloh, has been looking just like a mini-me version of her daddy by sporting short hair and wearing suits complete with ties, and now her famous parents are even calling her John. According to sources, Brad and Angie are very supportive of Shiloh's exploring the other gender. She wants to be a boy, so we had to cut her hair, Brad said when Shiloh was 4. And they go on in this article to talk about how early on they felt that she wanted to be called John. But there is a picture there of the baby Shiloh with a doll hugging it in her father's arms. And we have to wonder whether everybody supports this kind of thing. Now, the article there in the Examiner says, one person who's definitely 100% behind Brad and Angie's decision to call their daughter Shiloh by the name John is Chaz Bono, who was born Chastity to celebrity parents Cher and Sonny Bono and started to transgender in 2008. Shiloh is just like me, Chaz, 46, told a pal, who adds, seeing Shiloh behaving and dressing like a boy reminds him of his own childhood in the 70s. Not everyone agrees that Brad and Angie are doing the right thing, pointing out their daughter is awfully young to be doing this. Parenting expert Sherry Corso warns the couple is exposing Shiloh to possible ridicule. These are such interesting things here, and we have to look at it, and we have to make our own decisions whether we follow the scripture. But God will reveal things. Things cannot be hidden forever. There was a very interesting thing there coming out again of Globe. There was a picture on the front of it of a woman who is supposedly Princess Diana's secret daughter. And the resemblance is really astounding. And they say in their article The story parallels The Disappearance of Olivia, a book that mixes fact and fiction by American author Nancy E. Ryan. In it, Ryan claims that, and remember, this is fiction, you see, claims that in December 1980, Diana, then a 19-year-old virgin, had her eggs harvested and fertilized with Prince Charles's sperm to prove she could bear a royal heir. The embryos were later ordered destroyed, but a member of the medical team kept one and implanted it in his wife, who bore a baby named Olivia. Meanwhile, Sarah was born, and that is this woman who's claiming to be Prince Charles's real daughter, was born in October 1981, 10 weeks after Charles and Diana's wedding. When she was in her 20s, her parents were killed in a car wreck, and she discovered the truth of her birth in her mom's diary. Quote, Sarah tried to trace the origin of the donated embryo, but 2 years ago a message was left on her phone warning her to stop looking or else, says the insider. And they claim that she met with the Duchess of Cambridge, Kate. Sarah told Kate she became so terrified she moved to the U.S. She lives in New England but drove to Kentucky to see Charles. After Kate told William she believed Sarah's story, he convinced his father to meet her. The truth is, Charles was shaken by Sarah's likeness to Diana in her looks and mannerisms, says another source. Deep down, he suspects she is his child, but he'll never admit it. And there will be no DNA test. You might think that your problems are very, very great. But again, we're saying that God gives us strength for things that we can't even imagine. When I read this story, because I love to eat, I told Todd Waite today I was having a little trouble with a kidney stone, and I knew why, because I ate a whole lot of cheese the other day. I had a whole lot of pizza, and at the time, I sort of knew I will pay for this. You can't do that. You can't have a lot of salt, and that brings up another thing. All of you need to cut way back on salt and sugar if you want to be healthy and eat lots and lots of raw vegetables. It's so important. Well, anyway, again, I was in my little tabloid reading phase. Examiner for April 13th, Mom can't eat anything, and she hasn't had a bite in 7 years, and I'm going to have Lou read this to you. And as I look at this picture, there she is. She has no hair, and she has these two beautiful children, a little boy who looks to be about 3, and he has dark hair, beautiful brown eyes, and a little baby. They look so intelligent, so alert, so healthy. But if you think you have it bad, think about the heroism of this mother, and then pray for this family after you hear it.
And this is by Mary Melier. A mild case of the flu led to catastrophic tummy troubles for a woman who now can't eat for the rest of her life. But plucky Nicola Nichols hasn't let the devastating condition stop her from getting married and having two happy, healthy kids. Quote, "You take eating and drinking for granted until you can't do it," said Nicola, 25. She was stricken by the flu as a teen, and it led to her being unable to keep anything down, vomiting up to 50 times a day. After ruling out an eating disorder, doctors concluded that she has gastroparesis, an ailment that paralyzed her stomach muscles, so food could not flow through her digestive tract properly. Various therapies, including a gastropacemaker, failed to help, and she suffered intestinal failure, which prevents the breakdown of food and absorption of its nutrients. The end result is that Nicola has to be fed through a tube that delivers food and glucose directly into her bloodstream. She's been living that way for 7 years, and since there is no cure or effective treatment for her, she accepts the sad fact that she will never eat again. Still, Nicola and IT worker Ben fell in love and got hitched through their wedding, although their wedding was a mixed blessing for her. Imagine sitting at the head table at your wedding and watching everyone dig into the wedding cake that you made, and you can't have any, she says. It was a magical day, but it was so difficult. Fortunately, she couldn't have found a more understanding mate. When the condition caused Nicola's hair to fall out, Ben shaved his head in support. He joked, and this is a quote, he joked that he didn't want me to wake up the next day and be the only baldy in the family, she recalls. And despite the trials and tribulations of her condition, DeKohler, who lives in Bolton, England, feels blessed to have given birth to two healthy kids, William 3 and one-year-old Felicity. She says, quote, I call them my two miracle babies. On days when I feel as if I can't take it anymore, seeing their little faces light up is all I need to keep going.
Yes, the Lord will take care of his own. And now, when we're talking about things that we always have this underbelly of Satan's world, even the man killed by the NSA police, we had that headline April 1st. He had a lengthy record, but there was something more to it. These were two cross-dressing men who were fired upon by the NSA police. And it says, as it turns out, Hall and his passenger had just driven off in the SUV of a 60-year-old Baltimore man who told investigators that he had picked up the two strangers in Baltimore and brought them to a Howard County motel. Quote, we can't confirm there was any sexual activity involved, a Howard County police spokeswoman, Mary Whalen, told the Associated Press on Tuesday. So you can see here that underneath there's a second story. And what do we really want in our country? Do we want to hold fast for the sake of our families? Do we want to continue this, the Battle of Indiana, which Time magazine talked about? April 13th, it showed Freedom Fight with a cross on the front. The Attack on Gay Rights by Jonathan Rauch. The Attack on Believers by Rod Dreher. And I think this is very important to realize how the big corporations, the big global giants, mostly are coming out in favor of the homosexual lifestyle, and they're going to be a big spearhead toward persecution. We have the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, protesting the law on behalf of the world's most valuable company. Basketball Hall of Famer Charles Barkley wondered if Indianapolis was still fit to host the NCAA's much-watched Final Four, set to begin in about 2 weeks after Pence signed the bill into law. So many things here are just not good. And then we had Walmart, the CEO Doug McMillon urging on behalf of that huge retailer that Hutchinson reverse course, because Hutchinson is in Arkansas. A bill virtually identical to the Indiana law was sitting on the desk of Governor Asa Hutchinson. Now, we don't have a lot of time left tonight about this, but the person defending, are these laws necessary? Rod Dreher in Time magazine said, the reason Indiana is so shocking to those who oppose same-sex marriage, still 33% of the country, and I would think much larger, this is according to an NBC poll, has to do with the modesty of the Hoosier statute. The law does not guarantee a license to discriminate against gays and lesbians. Rather, it simply raises the bar for proving illegal discrimination in religion-related disputes a bit higher. All it does is grant believers the chance to make their case. What? Did you hear what I heard? In other words, we might not even be able to go to court to defend our own freedom. If you have a little business, don't you want to run the little business the way you want to run it? I think so. He says religious liberty, like free speech, is not an absolute right, but it is at the core of what it means to be an American. He says the illiberal liberalism on display in Indiana is absolutely chilling to us. We know how vulnerable that leaves us in our institutions going forward. So we don't want an America where the majority casts aside religious liberty and treats Orthodox Christians as outcasts. No, we do need much prayer. Tune in again to the Divided Kingdom next week. Good night.